How do you tell if a programmer's working hard? He's doing nothing. I'm not really sure if that's a joke or not. It's just sort of the sad intuitive truth. Howdy, howdy, ho, folks. I am Daniel Markham. It's Friday, end of week yet again. We're doing Nerd Roundup. If you haven't been with Nerd Roundup before, really, you're not missing a lot in life. But this is fun, and we have fun every week. What we do is a bunch of technical folks getting together every week, talking about what's been going on in the world from a technical standpoint. We try to model the behavior we like to see, and good teams are relaxed, have fun, and the humor and relaxed and sort of kicking around ideas like you might over a lunch table is the type of thing that actually advances the goal faster. So the less you do that, probably the worse off your team is. Today we have Greg Young. Greg, good to see you, my friend. So what sort of goodness have you been into? Have you been, we were talking about coding a little bit, and you said, what's up, dude?
Oh, well, I've been doing lots of fun stuff during the pandemic. It's actually been utterly bizarre. It being I work as a consultant going through the pandemic period. I'm accustomed to traveling 200 plus days a year, and that did not continue.
Yeah, road warrior stuff. You were talking, we've known each other for several years now, about how you've got a system for traveling, you've got backup currency always available, you've got sort of a way to get, I do that as well. I try to have some sort of way of getting where I'm going if the primary way doesn't work, right?
Well, normally, if you're traveling a lot, you're probably going to have 2 to 3 levels of backup. So a common form of backup that I would use when I was traveling extensively is there'd be at least $1,000 in cash in my backpack. If everything else goes wrong, you still have that.
I find people are pretty good about taking money. If your cards don't work, if something really bad, if you got enough cash, you can do a lot of stuff.
Well, it'll solve the vast majority of your problems. Although when you do end up having to use it, sometimes you'll get into very odd circumstances. Like I ended up having to use cash when I was in Hong Kong, and I wasn't able to get either of my credit cards working. And it was something like 4 o'clock in the morning U.S. time or 3 o'clock in the morning U.S. time. So it's like, what am I going to do? Call my bank right now?
I got into Chicago here once, and I was going to Southern Illinois. And there's a little commuter I had to take, but Chicago, right? So Chicago, snowstorm, nobody's going, the commuters aren't going anywhere. So now I'm calling, looking for a way to get, I don't know, 80 miles south. End up paying $400 for a rental car. Yep. I was like, shit. You got me, dude. You got me. Just name a number.
Well, and in today's world, it would be a little bit easier. You'd probably just Uber it.
Even 80 miles would not be that bad for Uber, probably 80, 100 bucks. It couldn't be too bad.
Yeah, I took one down to the Connecticut shore here, which is probably about that distance. And I'm trying to think. I think it was about like 100, 120.
Huh. I'm about 15 or 20 miles from the airport, but it's no lights. It's pretty much a straight shot. It was like $50 last time I Ubered home. It wasn't too bad.
Okay.
So this is, if you guys can see the screen here, this is the sort of the archive of stuff we're doing this week. As I talked last week, I'm actually taking a snapshot of these articles so they're not ninja edited or deleted or whatever. This week, I actually went in and made my little cards with headlines and such. This is on the Morg site, and it's a link from all the articles there if you're interested in getting the plain version. I found I had a hell of a problem actually finding plain text out of web articles. It's like trying to do some sort of, I don't know, wizard stuff. You're like, can I get plain text? Well, can I do like a reader mode? Can I delete this? Not so good. Programmers don't understand hash functions. I like this a lot because there's so much stuff that hinges off of hash functions. It's amazing. You start into hash, you go everywhere.
Hash functions are relatively simple.
They should be, yes. But, you know, I guess the guy made the point initially. He said, well, what is a hash function? He said, if your answer is I use that to salt my password, password file, then you don't know what hash function. Hash function is just a shorthand way. It's, I think CRC is probably a good way of thinking about it. It's a checksum type byte or series of bytes that represents the content that you're trying to snapshot.
Absolutely.
And
it's a shorter version of your data.
It is, and what happens is if you get a lot of like pictures or whatever, I think Apple's got the CSAM thing you're doing with the child, but the idea is you put together a hash and then you search the hash list instead of actually going through and searching the content. This actually happens a lot in database programming behind the scenes. This hashing happens every freaking where.
We actually use two distinct hashes inside of Event Store in the index.
Do you remember what they represent?
So basically, they are hashes of the stream ID.
Okay.
Because what you're going to want to look up is you're going to want to look up this stream name, and I'm looking for a certain event index inside of that stream. The way that that's actually done is there are two separate hashes taken, which are then stored into the index.
And see, even if it's a 60, usually you build your hashes along whatever your underlying OS word length is, 32, 64 bit. But however you do that, those things stack up quite easily on the CPU and you can search through them fairly quickly.
When I originally wrote it, I only used a single hash to start with. It was a single 64-bit hash of the stream name. Mm-hmm. The problem with that is what happens if you get a collision. So then we said, okay, we're going to make it two separate hashes. So we actually hashed the string using two different hash algorithms, and you have two 64-bit hashes.
And one is the stream. The second is the, what did you say, source?
No. It's two distinct hashing algorithms on the same string.
Ah. Okay. Well, then how do you prevent collisions but just doing hashing twice? I'm curious.
Well, the probability of running into a hash collision on the same string in both hashing algorithms.
Ah, okay. Riley's like, yeah, you could. It's like finding an atom in the universe. Yeah.
What's hilarious about this is after about 10 years of production use, we actually ran into this in production.
Good. Wow. That's wild.
So then the discussion became, well, should we add a third one?
And if you add a third one, you should have a hash for the hashes. That way you can search the three hashes quickly.
Well, you have to remember that a big part of the trade-off here is, I mean, in our index, there are, in some larger databases, billions of entries. So adding 4 bytes to an entry or 8 bytes to an entry is actually a substantial investment.
Yes. Yeah, you're running that database programming a lot. People will add an index to speed up a query, and the whole thing goes down because it's like, no, hang on. The database has to lock everything, go back and do all the indexing. No fun.
Well, and I'm trying to remember off the top of my head the number of bytes that were in an index entry in the original index. I want to say it was 22 bytes per entry. Like, I'd have to go look it up. But I'm reasonably close at 22 bytes. So adding another 4 bytes to that.
Times billions.
Yeah. It's a rather substantial thing to be doing.
Well, you know, about 10 years ago, Redis and a lot of other document-oriented memory-resident databases became quite popular. And I used to tell the joke that I was developing my own, and I'm going to call it a hash table. Because, you know, if you're doing document databases and it's memory resident, you know, that's pretty dang close to actually just doing a hash table lookup.
Absolutely.
I ran into hash tables. One more thing about hashes. I first ran into them doing object frameworks. Because if you ever worked in C++, there's a difference between equality and equivalence. And you can have an object that's equivalent to another object because it, the things inside it represent the same type things as the other thing, or you can have an object that's equal, which means it is exactly the same thing. There's no resides in the same memory address. It's the same thing. But to do hash collisions there, yeah, to sort that all out, you have to do hashes. So when you do, there's an equality function. Yeah. You get the equality function, and you say, hey, if this thing being passed in the equality function is actually me, then yes, and otherwise no. So it's cool stuff. I love hashes.
Hashes are my friend.
There have been some very interesting bugs around equality in .NET over time. Very, very interesting bugs. That's probably worth throwing up for a topic in the future.
I would love to do, a couple hours on actually setting up a good class graph where you do equality, equivalence, hashing, all the importance of those things that most programmers don't actually get experience with. The U.S. military may soon declassify a secret space weapon. Hey, dude.
The more interesting bit there is not that it would be what you expected. You'd kind of expect that they might say we're building a space weapon.
Yes.
No. This is one that's probably been up there for 25 years.
Yeah. I'm going with directed energy weapon, like a microwave type laser, because they've had microwaves since forever. And a big enough microwave, you can fry electronics of whatever. They're trying to prevent other countries from developing satellites that kill our satellites. Is the goal here.
Well, there's another weapon that I know they have discussed, but I don't know if it's ever been put up, which was basically a satellite that held a large bar of tungsten. And it was basically just one big bar. And what happens is, when you want to attack, you just take this thing over the city and you drop it.
It's like a nuke.
And because of the weight, it will actually have more energy than a nuclear weapon.
That's crazy. Well, back in the Star Wars days, they were talking about a thing called brilliant pebbles. And the idea was, instead of building directed energy weapons, we just build a lot of these things that would just throw rocks in from space, and that is a very scary thing, actually.
I believe that probably came from the same project set as the ones that were doing the tungsten bars.
And that's 40 years but old, so that they've been working
for a while. As far as I understand, those tungsten bars, if you have one of those dropped, you're screwed.
Well, you know, the Navy's been working on a rail gun for quite a while, and they've almost got it on a ship. I think they've kind of backed off a little bit lately because they're having problems with reuse. But a big enough rail gun with that tungsten bar, you know, you could put it about anywhere on short notice. Without a rail gun, you would have to actually make the orbital mechanics work out. Okay, but with the rail gun, you've got like half the globe to shoot.
Yep.
Next story, the chart.
And it's almost scary how good we are at coming up with ways to kill people.
Yeah, the Americans, we have Hollywood, we got killing people, I guess technology, bullshitting maybe, I don't know. We've been going at that for a long time. And what happens usually, and you probably know this, we're in a current state of cyber war. We have been for a long time. We invent these things. We fight amongst ourselves with other nations and, you know, sub Rosa. And at some point, somebody goes, you know, this is really dumb. Why are we doing this? And they try to outlaw it. Darn good. What is this? Observe the oscillations of a charm meson particle. A particle did something that changed the nature of reality. I love these headlines. So, like, we didn't get a holy grail this week, but we got changing the nature of reality. That's like, you look at it and you go, holy shit. Yeah, it's like the Matrix. Holy, Neo. So, all it is this charm meson particle oscillates between matter and antimatter as it goes along, and they finally prove for sure that's what it does. Now the question is, does it go more matter or antimatter? Because it could explain why we have matter and not so much an equal balance in the universe. That's sort of the long and short of that one. But yeah, changing the nature of reality. Hey, got to click on that, right?
Well, I'm lucky that I have a physicist in the family. So when I see those types of articles, I normally just send over to him.
What's going on here? Well, what tickles me, I enjoy these articles along with the biology articles, not as anybody who is an expert in the area, but I just enjoy watching the press and the public interact with people who are really, really smart. And it's, you know, the Holy Grail, changing the nature of reality. They try to come up with something that's a hook, but mostly it's this purple prose, like, you know, sweat-stained soldiers in the hot sun. It's like, no, it's just back off, dude. It's a little bit, you know, it's just a PR, you know, press release.
I don't know. I've really been waiting for all the COVID stuff to end so I can go on my trip. And this trip has been being scheduled for like 2 years at this point.
Where are you going?
The LHC.
Ooh, cool. Way cool.
So there's basically two parts to it. So the event store actually runs the control panel at the LHC.
I didn't know that.
Like, control system is run on event store. So part of it is to go there and see all of that, which is like, wow, this is
yeah.
So neat.
Ooh, yes.
And the other part of it is to actually go around the LHC. And this has been going for years, so I'm trying to remember what it was. It wasn't going to be like just here's on the public tour. It was like more of a private tour, we'll show you around type thing.
Yeah, fun stuff. I think some of my best memories working with clients or when I work with like a really large client and I get to bring my family in or get to do sort of a personal tour. Here's what we do here and all that. It's cool stuff.
Well, I've worked with a lot of clients where I could do some really fun stuff. So I don't know. Have you ever seen my GitHub photo?
I don't remember if I have, though.
My GitHub photo has been there for years and years and years and years. If you go look at it, it's actually me wearing an NOPD t-shirt because I used to work for the New Orleans Police Department.
Oh, cool. Wow. IT? Computer work, I guess?
I was actually a contractor, and I worked for another company, but what I did was I actually built their computer system.
Ah. So I worked my first commercial job, the project manager was a reserve deputy for Los Angeles Police Department. And you really haven't had a project manager. You had a guy who like trained in interviewing. He was like, how long is this going to take? Well, a month. Are you sure it's going to take? It's like, I don't know. Maybe a week. I don't know. I don't think I've done police. I've worked with FBI. I've worked with city governments, state governments, but I haven't done police yet.
The big messy part of dealing with police is you start getting into all of these weird formattings of things that need to be done. So like one that we were dealing with was called LIBERS, which is like the Louisiana Information Standard. But then you also have NIBERS, which is the National Information Standard. And they're different.
But of course.
It's like, why on earth would we not just all use NIBERS?
Yeah, I worked with a husband and wife team once. I was in Washington, D.C., and they had worked for the Washington, D.C. Police Department. So I'm like, hey, what's it like working for a police department? And they were like, you don't want to even think about working for you. it's a nightmare of paperwork and just BS.
What's funny is when you start getting into other places, even at the parish level, it was different between places in the parish. And it's like, how on earth can this possibly be working?
Yeah. Yeah.
You literally have no reasonable way of interchanging information between each other.
And I think
the kind of cool stuff that we were getting into, though, was breaking that. On a later project, basically what we were doing was building out something where you had these standards, and then you could take your information in whatever the hell it happened to be and map it to it.
Yeah. So my wife works for our local county government.
So in other words, it's like a generic adapter you can drop in.
My wife works for the local county government. She's a foster care supervisor. Her job is to help kids go back to families once they're removed. But as part of that job, when a kid comes into care, they have to go through she has to retrieve medical records. She has to get permission slips after the hospital. And there's just a ton of paperwork. And she was telling me, 95% of it's the same thing, just in a different online system or a different PDF or whatever. I'm like, holy cow, you could just plug that in like an XML document and just map that onto each of those forms and you'd at least be mostly done.
Yep.
Mm.
Well, I'm guessing, and I don't know their particular agency, that this is something that's not happening very often. And so people are just going, you know what? If it takes 15 minutes to do it, we'll just spend the 15 minutes because we do this twice a week.
She's talking about some of those documents, like 30, 60 pages. Who's the kid? Who's the kid's parents? Who's the kid's grandparents? What's the medical history? It goes on and on and on. And once you fill it out one time, it's like for each of the parents, what are their criminal histories, what are their credit histories? It sort of snowballs. I'm not a huge XML fan. XML was a good idea at first and kind of went downhill. But this is sort of I've got a group of stuff that needs to map to multiple places. This feels like XML XPath stuff to me, right?
I've had a love and hate relationship with XML. For a lot of things, I quite dislike it, but when you get into a problem where suddenly you actually need to use something like an XSLT, then it's wonderful.
It is, to me, well, it's a good question. We've got text configuration files, we've got JSON files, we've got the domain name value files. XML to me is good at when you want to do that grouping for a human to come in later on and look at, okay, I've got these natural grouping things are in this order. I can walk down the tree and find that to me seems like an XML type thing.
Yeah, but you can do that in JSON as well.
You can. You can. I think the problem with both JSON and XML was like they're really cool ideas that we've just sort of beaten the living shit out of so that you bring up somebody's actual XML. It's like, what did you do to this? This is, it's supposed to be a text markup language. Hello, ML. Oh, yeah. Mm.
Ah, but have you used XSDs?
But of course, you have to have XSDs. You have to have XSLT. You have to have XPath to match the. Oh, yes. We have a whole plethora, a family of XSLT. It's not like those poor JSON guys. No, we're in a bunch of stuff.
No. They've made most of those things for JSON too.
Well, it's not a standard file.
They actually have something equivalent to an XSD for JSON.
Oh yeah, I've seen that. I can't think of the name right now. It's almost like a
literally
whistle.
Nobody uses it.
So let's invent this loosely typed language called JavaScript. And then we'll just hang every son of a bitch thing we can find off of this loosely typed thing. And since it doesn't fit, we'll make those things strongly typed. It's like, no, stop. I don't want to ride the bus anymore. I want to get off. So the next article is Patterns in Confusing Explanations. And this article confused me, so I don't know if that's a good or bad thing. Great article if you guys are interested in this. She does a lot of here's how to explain things in a really cool way. You know, Greg, I really suck at explaining things. I just figured that out. I'm not that good a person. I don't know why. I think I assume too much out of people when I talk to them. What's been your experience teaching people? Have you had a was it rough going at first or what? You with us, Greg? Greg,
come back.
He's walking around. Greg. Dude, you there? Yeah.
I'm here.
So my question was what...
Oh, okay. It looks like my Wi-Fi came back.
What has been your experience learning how to teach people? Because I struggle with it. I seem to assume people know stuff that they don't. What's been your classroom experience? It hasn't been easy for me.
I think it's one of those things that you get over time. So once you've taught 200 classes, you have a very different feel for things than when you're on your fifth. And in terms of feeling out students, I tend not to do it in the classroom environment.
Yeah.
So one thing I do when I teach classes is I make sure that there's like an evening event that's going to be happening. And that's when I try to feel people out is during the evening event. You can also kind of get an idea of what relevant knowledge they might have.
When you do James has got the coolest gig in the world because he does the embedded TDD stuff. Gets out, he's got the whole stuff pre-bolted together. You just do some C programming. But when you try to move up to the meta level of teaching people coding, there's always this danger that it's just not sinking in. They're like, okay, this is fine. I don't understand it. But like you said, you have to feel out each person to make sure they're actually understanding what you're trying to tell them.
So one thing that I do in class, which is kind of unusual and you might appreciate, is the last hour or two of my class, I actually tell people specifically, I do not expect you to walk out of this class having understood the rest of the stuff that we're going to talk about at a complete level. Like, I'm going to give you some information about it, but I do not expect you to actually walk out having a full understanding of the concepts involved. We're at the tip of the iceberg. There's a whole lot more underneath everything that we're talking about.
I have done a lot of training. I mean, a lot, from 3 people at a time, 60 people at a time. Yeah. And I've worked with corporate departments that bought training. My earlier statement that I suck at it still holds. But the thing I found with corporations is if you talk to the people who understand training, they're like, you know, maybe 2-3 concepts for a whole day. If they get that, they're good, you've achieved your goal. But then the corporate side, they're like, send us this bulleted list of the 4,000 things you're going to teach us all in 8 hours. And they take the one that's got the coolest list.
So part of me doing that last little bit of training and the explanation that I give people is, I mean, we're going to be going over this stuff in about 2 hours. Just so that you know, I have another 3-day class I teach about these 2 hours.
I like that. That's a good idea, you know, where you kind of do whatever you're doing, but at the end you go, okay, these are 3 or 4 points here you may get hung up on. I'm willing to dive down on those later. I like that. It's pretty cool.
Well, and it's a rather large topic. So the last bit of the class that's discussing that, and I believe that people can even go watch those 2 hours if they want. I believe they're up on the online version of the class as well. It's process managers and sagas.
Process managers and who?
Sagas.
The story of an event would be a saga? Is that what, I don't know what a saga means.
No, saga is actually a pattern for doing process orchestration.
Ooh.
So it's a really, really cool pattern. You know what a process manager is, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's basically a messaging finite state machine that's going to move you through a process. A saga is a different pattern, and it's actually quite bizarre because a lot of people in the .NET community in particular think sagas are process managers, but they're not. They're actually 2 distinct patterns.
Okay.
So a saga is more like Do you know those brown envelopes that used to be in companies?
Yeah. Interdepartmental mail.
I'd put some documents inside of it, and then I'd write like five names down on the envelope. And the little mail guy's going to come over. He's going to pick it up. He's going to see the first name on it, and he's going to take that document over to whoever that person was or department is. They're going to receive it. They're going to do some stuff. They're going to scratch their name off of it, and they're going to put it back out in the mailbox. The department intermail guy is going to come, grab it. He's going to look, see the name scratched off, and he's going to bring it to the next one.
Cool.
And basically, we're going to do this until we reach completion.
Okay.
The last name that's on that envelope is going to be something like record storage.
Right, because you don't want to lose that. You want to, or you, to your point, the Vince story, you want to journal everything you have coming across.
Right. Now, in a saga pattern, that is exactly what we're doing. Now, the interesting bit then becomes, how do we handle failures in a saga pattern? And there's two general ways of handling failures.
I was going to ask about transactions, but like, oh, no. Okay, so what were the two ways? Roll back, reverse the envelope back out, or?
That is indeed one of the ways of handling failures. It's I unscratch the name above mine, and I put it back to them. I unscratch the name above mine, and I put it back to them.
Back pressure,
and
yeah.
Eventually, it'll go all the way back. The other one is that we actually have an error address associated with it.
Yeah. That's good. That's good stuff.
What's very cool about this is when you actually go through and implement this, these could just be URIs. And how much code would it take to write to build something that when it receives a document, it does what it's supposed to do based on the URI that it is.
Or pings another
UI. And then it looks for the next URI and forwards it to the next URI.
Well, Greg, you just explained to me why some of my microservices teams are struggling. No, I'm with you, and I'm with you as far as event processing goes. I think what happens with a lot of guys is they go from microservices directly into event queues, and then event queues becomes URIs, and then it's like, guys, just slow down. Let's make a little thing work, then make the thing more complex, and this may be where we end up at, but if we jump in too far, too quickly, we're going to be swimming around when, you know, how do I set my firewall up for the URI, and that's not where we want to be to begin with.
So the big problem that people have when they're implementing sagas, and I've seen this in company after company after company, I mean, they're really, really simple to implement. You can write a framework.
Oh, there are. There's a lot of frameworks for it. Yeah, sure.
But to handle this kind of coordination, I mean, even in class, we write one.
Yeah. So the thing is, yes, it's simple. But you know, the first thing they do is build a Docker image. It's like, okay, I want to add numbers. What's my Docker image for that? It's like,
That's not the big problem that you tend to run into. The big problem that you tend to run into is, okay, so I now have 17,000 of these running. Oh, what is the status of them?
Now, what's happening?
And remember, this is distributed, and it's XML documents going from place to place. So what people tend to forget, and this is a very common thing that you want to add, is that inside of my URI set, I also include a status URI.
Yes. Yeah, that's cool.
So that place to place, part of the protocol is when you receive something, you contact the status URI with, this is where we are, and now I have centralized logging coming back to my.
So when I do microservices, we take away the transport mechanism because it really shouldn't matter. If you're writing to the transport mechanism, you're coupling too close to the architecture to begin with. But that's where you end up. Once you get past three or four microservices, you're like, okay, I want to scale. How do I do logging? How do I do status to each machine? There's the whole, all that stuff. And I think people go to something like Docker because they believe that all of that's handled by the magic genie that lives inside there. And then, it's just another level of work, really.
The one that I tend to see a lot, and it's largely because of the kinds of clients that I work with, is people who are building out event-based architectures. And then you start getting into service A raises an event, which service B consumes. Service B then raises an event, which makes service C do something. Service C raises an event, which causes service A to raise an event.
Race conditions.
And now we end up in a cycle.
Race conditions. Yeah, you know, we have been here. It seems so familiar. You know, we've got mutexes, race conditions. Ooh, where have I heard these things before? Hmm.
Well, but what's really fun with those cases is that they're not always immediate.
Yeah.
Well, so it's not that this happens over the course of 5 seconds. This could be happening over the course of months.
This is the danger of over-engineering your message queue system, because it's not immediately obvious what it's doing. And it should be pretty obvious what's going on.
Well, there are some things you can do around this problem, and I've actually built systems that do this. So the two main patterns that you tend to be wanting to look for are correlation ID and causation ID. So basically now what I get out of this is you can consider it a graph showing the relationship between all of these events. And now we can start getting into categorizing those graphs. So when we see something like this has happened, it's like, well, has this ever happened before? Let's go take a look at all the graphs. Do any of the graphs have something that looks similar associated?
So what you end up doing is what the old what the current device driver guys are doing when they go through check out their multi-threaded applications. They're having to look at the stats, the CPU load, you know, the threads who are taking up the most time, the ones that are continue to run. Is the more cycles they give them, the more they continue to run. Fortunately, to your earlier point, in the CPU, it's usually pretty quick that you end up with that loop. I think my go-to for that would be subject area. Right? So the reason we got half-ass good at thread is that we just thread inside of one app. You know, message queues have a tendency to become just, you know, here it is, everything, which by definition makes it much more difficult to analyze. So next up is, have you ever heard this phrase, elite overproduction?
I have heard the phrase, but only because I saw the article.
So this has been around for a while. I can't remember where I heard it first. The idea being that you need so many lawyers and doctors. If you were to keep making a bunch of lawyers and doctors, you would actually hurt society, because you would end up with a bunch of highly trained people who would be driving buses or arguing about topics that you're wasting money training them, first of all. Second of all, they tend to associate with one another and create work where they might not be.
To be fair, I think pretty much every lawyer is a negative push on society.
What Shakespeare say? Shakespeare's first thing we do is kill all the lawyers. Yeah. I read this great article this morning. It was about epistemic trespassing. And this author's point was that once you get a group of professionals in a tightly knit area, the first thing you want to do is build a wall around that area and say, oh, you can't come here and tell us stuff. This is our own little club here. And it becomes an issue, and elite overproduction actually kind of drives into that. So I like this because there is a whole sort of slew of articles. There's the reproducibility crisis, epistemic thing, this thing here, where if you mention it to programmers, several of them, a significant percentage, will think that you're kind of being anti-intellectual. And it like flips a bit in their brain. And from once that bit is flipped, they're unable to have any reasonable conversation. You just forget it. It's not going to happen after that. They're very sensitive to expertise and sort of kowtowing to the appropriate people and all that. I'm not an elite guy. I just don't believe in elitism.
You really have to give programmers some credit in terms of not being elitists.
Yes.
Pretty much everywhere I have been, nobody gives a crap where you got your degree from. Yeah. Nobody cares what your PhD was about. what everyone cares about is, can you actually produce?
I'm with you. And to me, one of the reasons I love this gig and I love talking to you and doing the Nerd Roundup and teaching and all this is because, you know, programmers to me are like the applied philosophers of the 21st century. You just know a bunch of different kinds of stuff. We drop you into a bunch of really smart people and say, go solve their problems. And that's really cool. I like that. That's a fun, fun gig.
Well, what's kind of interesting with this as well is this is in many ways what a consultant does. So when you actually work as a consultant, a large portion of your work is coming in and saying, have you thought about looking at this problem from this angle as opposed to the angle you're currently looking at it with? And people go, huh? And then it's oftentimes, it might even take a day or two for that to sink in. And then it's, oh my God, I got it now.
I think the thing is that there a reasonable argument can be made that, you know, I don't want a programmer who's never flown an airplane flying the airplane, right? So, I mean, there is a role of training. However, there also is a role for just open discussion. Have you thought about this or whatever? I don't think everybody's a doctor or an airline pilot. That's sort of, that's taking things, right. Probably 1% of the people are the folks you're going to need like 12 years of stuff to do, right?
One thing I've always found interesting is, so when you go to, let's say, a bank and you talk to their people who are going to be doing hiring, they are trained to look for people who, you know, they were at their previous job 5 years or more. But in reality, you oftentimes want the opposite of that.
Yeah, the guy they're looking for don't make waves, stays for a long time, you know, never very loud about anything. It's like, well, wait a minute.
But very often, you want the precise opposite of that. You want the person who's going to come in and go, what in the hell have you guys done here?
I know. What the hell? This is my circus clown theory of consulting. And the idea is that there are so many groups in various professions that a circus clown could just show up and ask dumbass questions, and actually the group would advance towards some goal. I'm not sure how I can turn that into class. I'm working on the class part of
that one.
I haven't got the class worked out yet. It's going to have a nose and like a squirt flower and stuff. So you'll like.
But
this.
Are you going to be wearing it though?
If they pay enough, it depends on how the money works, Greg. You buy me dinner, a couple glasses of wine, I'll dress like a clown. All right. No. So this next article is a noted study in psychology.
Will that be with this? Will that be with the squeaky noise? Like, this sounds completely worth it for dinner.
It does. Yeah, that probably does. Yeah, I have to stay off social media for the rest of my life. I used to love doing, like, ridiculous fun stuff to try to help people learn. And the problem was that there's this bona fides that they're expecting out of you, and it's just fucked up. It's like, if you understand how fun programming can be and we can kick back and do stuff, by definition, you must not be a serious person. That, you know, this is like, okay, well, this is... Not somebody that takes this job as seriously as they should. It's like, no, fuck you. Actually, the joking part and kicking back and laughing part is how you get the circus clown, how you get the sort of outside-the-box thinking. You start, oh, wait a minute, this looks like a different way. To your point, the things that we hire for and that we think are the good things we want many times are exact opposite of what we really need.
So we used to do an exercise that might be fun for some people to hear. And it was actually finding the worst way to solve a problem.
Oh, I like that.
So we know that we have this issue. What would be the worst possible way that we could solve it? And the reason that this was such a good exercise is you actually start finding things inside of your worst possible solution that exist in some solutions that you are actually putting forward.
And it's interesting, if you tell a joke about what you're doing, you're actually taking some other domain, some other model, and you're applying it to your current work, and it's all, why did this kind of funny? I didn't see it worked out that way. That's exactly the type of stuff you should be doing. Oh, wait a minute, there's a metaphor here I can use from somewhere else.
The coming up with the worst way of solving things also is kind of funny.
I tell you, the like worst
example. People have a good laugh over it.
Yeah, the worst example many times makes you focus on, well, what part of this is actually important? Right? So if you try to come up with the worst example, the goal here is to try to find the most important thing and turn it upside down. Well, what is that thing? Is it speed? Is it whatever? Resilience? And then by flipping it over, you're actually finding the thing you should have been looking for to be in the first place.
Right. And it's a very fun exercise to go through.
I love actually the part, like you said, go to dinner after the class or whatever. I love the parts where you're meeting informally and you're talking about the work and you're trying to say the worst way to do it. What could be the funniest way to do it? Could we actually do this with one person? How stupid could that one person be? I've done this thing before. Can we do this using clipboards? It's like, well, I guess so. Well, if we did, how many clipboards do we need? And of course, you're asking a database design question, but they don't know that. They're thinking clipboards.
Right. Well, one I tend to ask a lot to, this is more for business people than for developers, is let's imagine that we didn't have the computer system. Yes. How would we do this with pieces of paper?
This is what I'm getting to, yes. And tell you, the cool thing is if you ask a programmers or business or a mixed team, it forces them to think about the actual work they're asking the system to do instead of the technology. I think probably the biggest anti-pattern I've ever seen in teams, it's weird to say this, is that the business customers get into implementation questions and it gets all wrapped up into politics and then the tech team can't move anymore. And that sucks. That's well, I want the business team.
This is coming all the way back to sagas, but that's actually how we get into the discussion with them. Is how would we do this with pieces of paper?
Yeah. It is. We see
what would that piece of paper look like?
What will happen? I guarantee you is that somebody will say, "Hey, we need to move to an asynchronous events message queuing system," and that will be translated into, hey, we need to buy IBM Message. We need to do this. We need to buy this thing. And somebody will say, but why? And then they'll say, well, so we can do faster reporting. It's like everything has to be dumbed down to the point that it doesn't even represent the thing you're doing anymore. And then you're sold. You're locked in at that point because they bought this big multi-million dollar thing so they can have reporting. And by dummy, reporting it better work.
This is a relatively common thing to find.
So, noted.
There's an old joke that the most important technology decisions are usually made in expensive steakhouses.
Yes, I completely agree with that. That's been my experience as well. I've seen many, many multi-million dollar projects kicked off with very expensive meals.
And there was nobody technical in the room.
Yeah, or if they were, they weren't going to spend too much time trying to find things wrong. They were just trying to find things to say. Some of the worst people I've worked with, and this is a horrible thing to say, are the people who are just the most friendly people to be around. They're kind, they're caring, they're great to talk to, and then they'll sell you anything, whether it works or not. So, noted study in psychology fails to replicate. These guys did this study 10 years ago about lying, and it's been cited 400 times in other papers. This guy wrote the book on being honest and how to make people more honest and all this stuff. And the data is made up for the study. It's like on the job training. You believe this? Cool, I got a book. And the way.
So,
go ahead.
This one is definitely going to my mother.
Oh, my God. What does she do?
My mother is quite literally a psychologist.
Oh, wow. Well, she's probably heard of these guys, I'm sure.
She does not do much practice today. She is retired.
Okay.
She still maintains some clients in a private practice, but only a few.
The not only is this completely ridiculous to begin with, they tried to hang on to it, even though it became obvious it was fake. And finally, statisticians had to come out and say, no, look, we can mathematically prove that this is bullshit. And NPR had done a story, I guess within the previous month, it was like, no, there are a lot of cranks that think this isn't true, but these are people you can't try. And so NPR was like, whoopsie, maybe these guys are wrong. So the paper's retracted. There's this big kerfluffle.
It's happened before.
It has. It has. But people who did a paper on lying are actually lying. There's some meta recursive thing in that. I'm not sure how that works. So the guy who did the statistics to do the proof that this thing was total bullshit has another page here that goes over all the different ways you could screw up with statistics when you're doing science. And yeah, there's just hundreds here. So,
I don't know if you've ever looked into it before. Did you know that there are some defined ways of how to look at statistics for manipulation?
You mean like p-hacking?
Essentially, yeah. That's one form.
Cohort analysis would be... Actually, what you're trying to do when you're doing like social recommendation stuff, you're trying to find arbitrary groups of data you can stick together.
Well, but other things that you're looking at are, for instance, in data sets, what are the distributions of values?
Oh, yeah. There's the thing about the numbers where you can go back and see that whether somebody's actually manually entered the numbers.
Right. There's all sorts of neat things like this that you can actually do on top of the data to... It won't give you a certainty of whether or not it was hacked, but you can have a reasonably solid idea just based on looking at the numbers themselves.
I when I look at stats, and I took, I guess, probably half a year stats in college. I didn't take very much. But when I look at some of the different ways you can screw it up, and I read papers that are screwed up, it's like, I really doubt that most scientists who are writing papers have the statistical background they need to actually be using the data the way they're using it. A lot of different ways to screw up. And what's the old saying? If you torture the data long enough, it will confess. Speaking of data, that's Greg, can you hear me? He cannot hear. He goes away. You can see him.
So there's a lot of interesting cases.
Yeah. Yes?
Ah!
All right, where are you doing, Greg? Can you hear me? I don't know what to do. I can see him. So
It looks like I'm getting Wi-Fi in and out.
I can see you. Your video is still here, but it's like you cannot hear me and I picking you up intermittently.
Do you hear me now?
I can hear you. I've been able to hear you all along. You can't hear me. Hello? Yeah, I think you've got a Bluetooth headphone issue, dude. It's not your Wi-Fi. Your Wi-Fi is fine. It's your headphones. You need to get you some razor phones, dude. And he'll come back closer to the PC. Hey, can you hear me now? Hey, Greg.
Woo-hoo.
Can you hear me?
I hear you. Do you hear me?
I do. I've been hearing you all along. I've been seeing you all along. I think it's your headphones. It's your Bluetooth headphones,
no,
dude.
No, it's not. It's not.
Then how could I see you?
I just sent you an email.
Ah, okay.
It told me, even though you could apparently still hear me, that I was not even connected to the meeting.
You're kidding me. Well, yeah, I could see you just fine. That's weird.
Like, I even sent you a screenshot from my side where it said that you were disconnected.
Oh, yeah, I've been watching you walk around, smoke a cigarette. A good thing you don't, like, pick your nose a lot or anything, because that would be embarrassing.
I only do it on Tuesdays.
You're big on nose picking on Tuesdays. What was the old Seinfeld
thing?
Well,
you got to search for treasure someday.
What was the old Seinfeld joke? There was no penetration. I was scratching my nose. So here is this next article. This is a cool article because they're using artificial intelligence to send people to jail. And I thought it would be like an artificial AI cop or maybe an AI judge, but no. What they're doing is you're using AI as the computer itself as an expert witness. And you're saying, but the computer says this person must have done these things. How are you going to cross-examine the computer? I don't know.
There's also a significant question about the information that the computer has to make decisions off of.
This is the thing we're doing. We're creating these artificial intelligence systems that are unable to explain their inferences. And then we're saying, well, the inferences must be correct. It's like, no. You, unless you're explaining what you're doing, you're not really, it's just it's a parlor trick. It's not intelligence. So I don't know what to do with that, but that's messed up. That's probably that's one of the most messed up things I've seen actually in a while. Inference systems, yes, there are systems that will
explain. They actually tell you why.
Yes, that is a true path toward intelligence, I think. Yeah, this to me, I mean, I do this libertarian hair on fire thing, but this idea of using AI as an expert witness, that's really messed up. That needs to be stopped right away, pretty much. So this is probably the nerdiest article this week, and we've only got a couple more. If you want to bail, that's fine. But this one is, don't attach tooltips to document body. And long and short of it is, this guy had a performance issue, dug down through all the tracing and everything. And the browser, as you bring up a page, builds a tree of document object model nodes and a tree of spile nodes and a tree of JavaScript. And if you were to go attach something on the root, even if it's not displayed, it causes to re-render all of those trees. So just leave that alone. But he said you could even make an empty div underneath the document. Just stick it in there. It works the same way, but it doesn't cause it to re-render. So this great deep dive on the DOM tree and the style tree and all that. And at the end of the day, it's like, how would anybody know? Like, I'm teaching somebody JavaScript and how to do DOM manipulation. I got to go into this whole thing to show them, you know, all this linkage stuff behind the scenes. It's insane. I don't see how you would train that. It's weird.
Well, you'd probably train it in roughly the way he's written it there. Don't do this, and this is why you don't do it.
This is actually pretty cool for folks who actually have a performance problem. They want to dive in because he goes through the screens to use and how he went through that problem. But this is almost like reading those old articles you read about how people would have page faults, and the page fault would cause the program to skip 200 milliseconds or whatever. And it's cool stuff, but then you're thinking, holy shit, do I really have to get the ICE debugger out to figure out where the page fault is here?
Oh, come on. You know you love pulling out GDB or ICE debuggers. Have you ever had to pull out a hardware debugger?
Oh, my God. No, thank God. Thank God, yeah. May the great pumpkin save me from hardware debuggers.
I've got a really good one, and this one goes back some years ago. We were having a bug inside of algorithmic trading code, and I was looking at this for like days and days and days. I had full memory dumps. I had shown that the problem exists. I literally had a memory dump with the program in the state that it was in being broken. And you know what we finally found out the cause of the bug was?
I do not. What was it?
It was a bug in the Pentium chip.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Weren't you the one telling me about, like, a bug in the compiler? Somebody was telling me the other day about...
I have run into those as well. But this was actually... a bug in the Pentium chip. We ended up with two threads inside of the same critical section.
And that's not
and it was this version of the Pentium chip somehow allowed this to happen. It worked on any other version of the Pentium chip aside from the one that happened to be in this machine. Like, we just went out and bought a new machine, and the problem went away.
It went away. Hey, new machine. What? See, you realize, and I'm sure you do realize, that when we started programming, you had a CPU, and the CPU had a clock clicked on. Every time the clock clicked, the CPU did some work. Well, that's been abstracted out, so now it's all microcode at the CPU level. So the CPU itself, your Pentium, has a set of code built into it to make it work. The next Pentium may have a different set of code.
Well, what was funny with this was we had isolated this bug. We had memory dumps. So I was able to prove that this bug actually occurred.
But you couldn't find it.
No. I gave all of this to Intel.
Okay.
And I even after, I mean, there must have been 100 emails that went back and forth as I was escalating up from, like, their first level support person to, I'm talking to somebody that's on the team actually designing the chip. And until they finally went, holy crap! This is actually occurring!
I try to bail out, and I've run into situations where I thought, hey, I'll, you know, escalate or whatever. It's like, unless it's mission critical, you know, you can spend a lot of time. Did you unplug the computer? It's like, no, I don't really have time for a lot of that.
What was kind of fun with Intel on this one was, remember, I had fixed my problem within the first week or so. Even, like, I figured out what it was, and that it was a processor bug. So, and the way around it was, we're going to buy a new processor. We're going to change out the machine. No problem. But it literally dragged on for months, escalating through there, and to the point I'm talking to people actually involved with designing the chips. Until finally one of them went, holy crap, you're right.
Yeah. And then you're wondering, why am I doing your work for you? What is the purpose of me doing this work for you?
And this is where it got kind of fun. Because once they realized that, I have actually been, like, literally there were hundreds of emails associated to this over months. And it was probably one of the biggest bugs reported that year about their chips. You know what ended up happening? They came up and brought me out to a nice dinner.
Yeah, the steak dinner. You go to the nice steakhouse, yeah. It begins and ends at a steakhouse. Most of that's cool.
It was kind of cool. I mean, what you're talking about having people from, like, the Intel architecture team taking you out to dinner. It's like, you know what? This is pretty cool.
I have done the go out with the super nerd thing, and that, you're right. That is pretty damn cool. One of the things that you have to do is sort of skate where skating's okay and dive deep where diving deep is okay, right? And along those lines, somebody said, hey, guys on Hacker News, what are you using? If you're working by yourself and you're making money, what's your tech stack look like? And I was fascinated by this because there are people making millions of dollars who are doing IT-intensive stuff, and they're their only guy. And I'm like, that's pretty damn cool. When I work with organizations, sometimes it takes 20 people to write a login screen. So cool stuff.
And this... So one of the best things that people should be looking at today in terms of possible career development is getting more into the DevOps side.
Yes. I agree.
And actually running production tech stacks.
I agree.
There is a distinct lack of people doing that.
Crypto and DevSecOps would be the two things if I had to go in the industry right now. They're where the future is, both of those things. I read today that they have machine learning ops.
I was going to say, what's been bizarre for me is that you have not seen more people going into DevOps.
See, the crazy thing is, and I've struggled with this, I would really love to teach DevOps. It's something I've done. it's a fun thing to do. It's going to be the future. But hell, Greg, I mean, DevOps by definition is the whole freaking stack. So do you start with how to write a C program in GCC and work up from interrupts all the way up to, you know, cloud apps? But because if you start at cloud apps, you're missing a whole bunch of stuff down underneath there.
No, I think I know where I would start with people.
Okay.
I'd start with the concept of resiliency.
Okay.
And then move forward from that. So everything revolves around resiliency. Now, there's many ways of dealing with resiliency. So, what do failure scenarios look like in terms of probabilities, distribution? Okay, now that we've gotten through all of this, how do we start handling things?
Me and Michael Feathers
and
I...
How do we mitigate things?
Michael Feathers and I have talked about this several times, and it's interesting because if you learn to program sort of the app level, say command line app level, there are two ways of looking at this. First is I write an app, and either it works or doesn't work. If it doesn't work, what happens, to your point, right? The other way of looking at it is I write an app, it doesn't work, oh, it's broken. And the resilient way actually lets you scale out over time. If you stick with that philosophy, but we don't teach that way. We just teach, well, it's broken. It's like, no, it's not broken. You're not failing correctly. It's not just broken. And now his head is frozen. Yep, we've entered the cryonics phase of the show. I don't know if he's coming back or not, my friends. Maybe he has lost it. he coughed. You're back.
Oh, I'm back.
You just kind of froze for like 10 seconds, like Han Solo.
No. What happened was my phone ran out of battery, and I had been running on my phone because the hotel Wi-Fi wasn't working. And then I connected back to the hotel Wi-Fi, and it is working.
Oh, so you're in a hotel now. Golly gee, yeah. That you said that you were looking to get out. I don't blame you. Gee, that kind of sucks.
If you want to have like a really crazy story that people can kind of relate to,
but why not? What in the world have you? It's a mirror and a TV. I'm missing.
That's a TV and a TV.
You've got two TVs.
Actually, I've got another one right over there. There are in fact three TVs here.
Why?
What happened was the one that was installed by the hotel went out a week or so ago. There was a storm, and it no longer turns on. So then I went out and I bought a Roku TV, if you know them.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I installed it over where that other new TV is. And then there was another storm, and that TV went out.
What the hell?
Yeah, I think they might have some electrical issues here. So now I have a new TCL TV, which is put on top of the dresser there. I have literally had two televisions go out over the course of like the last 2 weeks.
So the last time I had a television go out in a hotel room, I had robbers coming through the window to clean the room out, and I had to run out of the room before they got in. They broke the glass, and I went running out of my shorts down the hall. There's robbers in my room. It was very exciting. They took the TV, oh.
What's kind of funny is that the maintenance here knows about all of this.
They know you put the Roku TV.
They just don't have a new TV to replace the broken TV with. They know it's broken. They know it's not my fault. Like, he even came up and went, this is obviously not true. Something that you have done. Like, there's literally no physical damage in any way, shape, or form to that television.
You'd think a surge protector would kind of help with something like that, really.
And it went out on the night of a big thunderstorm. So it doesn't take a whole bunch of figuring out
this is a Scooby-Doo show. Yeah, you should be this pretty easy. It's the storm.
But it's been going for weeks.
Wow.
Did I mention that here's an odd hotel?
An odd hotel?
It's very odd.
Is this like the Bates Motel? Is there this is a national chain or?
This is a local hotel. And today it's currently quite reasonable, with the exception of the TV, but it's been extraordinarily odd staying here. So I'm not sure if you knew this, but during COVID days, a lot of the states actually came through. And when you had more like business traveler hotels, like apartment hotels, they converted them to Section 8 housing.
Oh, wow. I did hear New York State, I think I heard they did that. I didn't know they did it in other states.
They did that here in Connecticut, oh, and wow. They did it to this hotel.
Oh, wow.
So it was literally one day this hotel was like a business traveler type hotel. And the next day there were stabbings happening outside. there were needles being left around.
Yeah, last time I went to Silicon Valley to work, I think the high was $7.95 a night. It was just insane. So I stayed at some local hotel, and it was the same thing. Shootings, stabbings. It was very exciting.
But what was really interesting is that support ran out.
Ooh.
And then I've jokingly called it, talking to family members, et cetera, that this hotel had the great exodus. It was literally all these people moved out on the same day.
Oh, wow.
Just imagine, like, the carnage of moving out 80% of the people in a hotel.
Think of the cleaning. The paperwork, the cleaning. It's just, wow, it had to be a nightmare.
Like, the dumpsters were overflowing with things. It was pure carnage.
When I stayed in Silicon Valley, I was in Mountain View. There was a murder like two or three doors down from where I was. They had the tape up, and it was, it turns out when you travel a lot, even when you don't want to be about crime, you end up at times being kind of in some bad spots.
Yeah. I actually had a funny one. I went down near Old Saybrook, Connecticut, if you know the area.
Hmm. Which part? Central, west, east?
That's roughly central. It's down by where the sub-base is.
Okay.
So, I go down there and I'm staying in a hotel. And the hotel says, oh, we need to switch you from room to room. I said, okay, no problem. I go up to my new room. I walk in, and keep in mind, I've had my key for less than 5 minutes at this point. I look up, and there is a syringe on the top of my mirror.
Oh, wow.
And it's filled.
Oh, wow.
So I take a photo of it, and I go walking down to the front desk, and I said, excuse me, ma'am, the room that you just moved me to, there is a syringe sitting on top of my mirror. Could you please have the hotel employee come remove it? I don't want to touch it.
I would like the non-hypodermic rooms. I'm good, yeah.
Well, it's not only that, it's also that even if I were to pick it up and walk it outside to the garbage and put it in, there is a non-zero risk.
Hepatitis C, I think, actually goes through touch, so that's not something you want to mess around with, and you're bad stuff. Hepatitis C's go through touches. That's the reason why if you have hepatitis C, you work at a food place, they have to shut the whole place down.
What was hilarious was the reaction to this.
What did they do? The manager come down?
Well, why did you put? Why would you have drugs in your room?
I do not have drugs. Yeah, well, this is your room. I just got here. Yeah,
I literally had my key for like all of like 3 to 5 minutes. I walked from the front desk up and came back. Well, why would you put it there? Are you trying to get something free?
Have you done the thing where they give you the key to a room that's already used and you go in the room and somebody else is there? That's a lot of fun. You make new friends quickly.
I have done that.
Like, oh boy, I didn't mean to do that. I don't know. This is, and you check the number and oh, wow.
Well, the really fun one with that, I had it happen in London, was I went to the room and there were people in there and it's like, you know, we're kind of going back and forth like, what the hell is
going
on?
Yeah, who's supposed to be here? It's like, I got the number right here, bub.
Well, and this is where the funny part came in. We ended up getting everything sorted, and then we all went out to some dinner and drinks.
Oh, that's so cool. That's a cool story. Yeah. So I got two more articles. The next one is Google's Project Hug. Hey, who wouldn't want a hug from Google? And if you've worked on the App Store,
I'm pretty sure you're already being hugged by Google. You just don't know it.
It's a hug from behind, I think. But the thing about if you've worked on made an app on Apple or Google, Android, you understand the concept of an App Store. People buy stuff. You get 30%. The store gets 70%. That's pretty standard. So you might wonder, why doesn't Blizzard, some of these bigger companies, make their own App Store? Because they could make a lot more money. And the answer is, behind the scenes, Google has went back and is paying them under the table. So they get a lot more than 30%, but nobody knows. It's like, thanks, Google. Wow. Yeah, that's just fucked up. That's really, really messed up. I would never write for an app store. Just forget it.
I could completely understand if the numbers were reversed on that. If it was Google was taking 30%.
Yes.
And then I would even think 30% to be high. But it would be kind of like, you know, I can understand it.
Amazon,
when we're talking 70%, it's completely nuts.
Amazon wants that for ebooks. I did publishing on Amazon for a while, and it was like, okay, you sell a book for $10, you get $3. It's like, well,
yeah.
So people ask me, you know, why do you self-publish? Is it a vanity thing or whatever? It's like, no, I'm just, this is an open platform. We can anybody in the world can publish here. Why the hell do I want to go and lose 70% to somebody else?
Well, and the physical book publishers are not much better.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you sold 27,000 copies of your book. Here's your $11,000 check.
Yeah, I had to make a choice. I've had a couple people offer to do the intros. You know, I'm a freelance writer as far as the big companies go. And yeah, I don't know. I'm happier with 100 people buying the book a year. I can become friends with them. We can talk about tech stuff. It seems to be a much more fulfilling relationship than 5,000 people buying the book really cheaply and then complaining. And that just seems like I don't want to go there.
Well, so, you know, I have versioning in an event source system that's been written.
Right.
And I've had it online. I have talked to multiple publishers about publishing that book. There is actually, and a lot of people don't know this, completely different artwork that's been done for the book. Like, it's all ready for publishing.
Cool.
I actually hired a guy when I was in Spain who was literally an artist to hand-draw everything. But once you start talking with the publishers about getting it out, it's just...
You become
the process and like what you would make out of it.
It's like a machine. Yeah, you're just being plugged in this meat grinder where you're going through all these hoops and everything.
It's like, wait, so at the end of the day, this will probably end up selling, once we push it out through everything, 5,000 physical copies, and in the end, I will receive $3,000.
It's okay. I mean, it's fine. I tell people, if you want to write a book, I mean, I'm happy I wrote 2-3 books. I'm happy to write this fourth one. I enjoy it, but it is a slog. I mean, writing a book is not like just going at the park or anything. You're looking at multi-months of work and the proofreading. It's not trivial. But the problem, you run into this with startups as well, is that there's so many things in life where there's this machine that they'll plug you into and it'll just kind of process you. It's like you have to make a call whether or not you really want to be part of that process or not.
So there's another side of this, which is relatively recent in terms of it being built up, in that there are some, they're like micro publishers. So instead of going to like an A Press or one of these big publishers, these micro publishers basically... they will help you get to the point where you've designed your cover, you've done your layout. So now you essentially have the images of all the pages. You have the standard stuff that is required for the printing.
Right. Yes.
And they're, what a lot of them are even doing now is they even offer on-demand printing.
I use LeanPub, and LeanPub lets me. I check my stuff into GitHub. When I check it in, the webhook compiles it all into a doc, and then LeanPub will actually plug into an on-demand publisher if I wanted to. So it's all kind of handled, and I think they pick up 20 or 30%. It's not the majority. They pick up a little bit, and I'm okay with that.
Now, who are you using through LeanPub to actually put out printed versions?
I've looked that up, and I haven't done that yet. I want to, but
so that's where I'm at right now. I have all the stuff on LeanPub.
Okay.
And now I've been talking to publishers about taking the stuff out of LeanPub and into physical books.
Well, you know that a lot of local printers will do books. I mean, it's not book binding if you're doing one at a time. It's I looked this up. Amazon, you can do it through Amazon. You publish on Amazon. Amazon's got people, they'll pick up the book. But to your point, publishing for an ebook, I've got Markdown, it compiles to whatever you're using, EPUB or whatever. That's not the same as creating galleys for a book. A galley creation, you got pagination, you've got the graphic layout. It's a whole different thing.
Well, but much of your pagination type stuff will happen in your PDF export.
Yes, but you need to...
It's not going to be perfect, but it's going to be relatively close. Like, we're talking, you need somebody to go spend a day on.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I've done layout for a newspaper. I've done graphic layout years ago. And one of the things you have to do is they actually print the book. If you think about it, a page of the book is actually four pages. It's two pages you're looking at here in the beginning and two pages at the end. They fold together. They sew it all together. So there's a whole thing about getting the pages reshuffled. And it's not impossible, but it's more stuff.
Yep.
I raised the price of my book, and I had somebody email a couple months back and said, "Hey, why is your book so expensive?" Emailed them back like, "You know, you're right. I'm doubling the price again on that thing." Okay, I've got people complaining. I'm not charging enough.
what's kind of funny about the one that I have up is the entire book is actually free to read in HTML format.
There you go.
And then it's basically, I forget what it's at right now. I think it's like a minimum of $2 to download the PDF.
Yes. See, that's the way most authors go. It's like the $1.99, just get the book and use it. And I grok that. That's just not the way. I wanted to actually go the opposite way, just to see what was out here.
What's kind of funny with it is in having talked to publishers, et cetera, like, I have well more than 1,000 people who have bought it, even when it's there and free to read. And then I also have, like, when I talk to publishers telling me, but we're not sure if there's much of a market for this because it's a very niche topic. And it's like, well, you already have sales data.
Right.
I'm relatively certain there are some people that are interested in this content.
It is a difficult decision because if you're selling for under $10, for instance, which is a kind of sweet spot for a lot of authors, are people buying it that would still buy it at $39.95? I don't know.
That is a fair statement, and I don't think it's really possible to do proper market research on that.
It isn't. You're lucky because you're doing event store. This is good hard math, good solid coding stuff. I worry about the folks like myself who moved up a little bit of more of a meta level. Once we start doing mass market research, I worry about us pandering to the people we're trying to sell to instead of actually helping them out.
That's reasonable.
Yeah, I think plus you lock yourself in so quickly. You know, if you just say rabbits are good in your first book, well, you're kind of stuck being pro rabbit for the rest of your life, and it just doesn't feel right to me. The machinery around providing sort of consulting advice to me shouldn't be mass marketing.
Well, but the first thing that you need to learn is that you need to qualify everything that you say, so that you would never say rabbits are good. You would say rabbits are usually good.
You know, what I used to love to do is that we would have a client in, we'd be delivering a software to them or whatever, and they would ask a question that would be reasonable, like, isn't this thing a piece of shit? I mean, if it had some problems or whatever. And everybody in the room knew what it, that there was a problem. And so I used to love standing up and then just sort of free-forming some kind of logistic book. Well, you know, it seems, and it may appear to be, and everybody, it was just a performance. It was fun. They realized that there was a problem they had to fix. It worked for everybody. I don't like it so much when people try to mislead on purpose.
So I have had that discussion many, many times. And I will actually normally turn that back around. Discussing the current problems associated with software is likely not productive. What we should be focused on is what are the good aspects of the software that are worth saving?
Yeah, well, that's good. I'm writing that one down. You can also take the question and answer with the question. Like, isn't this broken? Well, what makes you feel it's broken? You can play that game for a while, too. That's all kinds of fun. Well, why would you say that?
But you're actually trained in quite a few, like, if you go do, like, consultant classes, or if you go work for a big consulting firm, they're going to put you through classes.
Sure, sure.
But this is actually something that you get trained in.
Oh, yeah.
Focus on the positive as opposed to the negative.
And one of the first things you do in technical coaching is ask people, what is your vision for where you would like to be 3 months from now?
Well, no, that's not where you start. Where you start is, where do you want to be 3 years from now?
Oh, yeah, well, I'd like to see even better, yes, yeah.
And then we start working back about how we're going to get to that spot 3 years from now.
I haven't applied for a regular job, I don't know, 20, 30 years, a long time. But they used to ask, well, what would be your ideal position? Like, I would like to lay on the couch and have the money directly deposited into my checking account. That's the old, if we can work toward that in some fashion, I'm on board.
During the pandemic, with all of the crazy things that were happening, I actually said, you know, maybe I'm going to go work for a company for 6-12 months, something like that. Just because I can't travel, I can't do any of the other things. And I went through some interviews, and oh dear, they were interesting.
Ah. Did you go through the grueling 4-part interview or that?
I've done all sorts of different types of ones.
I had this one interview once where there's like 8 people in the room on a conference call, and they would all just shoot questions at me, and I would have to answer them all quickly.
I think my favorite interviewer was the one that told me that I didn't understand event sourcing. And I didn't really know what to say at this point. It's just kind of, well, I think I'm going to have to say that we're going to agree to disagree on this.
Yeah, I did write that. Yeah. So I interviewed with this large Virginia company, which will go unnamed, I think back in the .com 20 years ago. And I went down and did the interview in person. I did the screening and went in person. And they gave me these mind puzzler things like, you know, Joe is walking 6 inches per minute and is... this guy's walking 3 furlongs per year, and they're holding 6 pounds. It was like, 20 units of stuff, and I was expected to solve it all on the whiteboard. Well, I just flailed around. I hadn't done unit work in a long time. And they deemed it, well, sorry, you're just not the kind of guy we're looking for. So flash forward 10 years, I was hired as an enterprise technical coach by the same company. I couldn't come in as a developer, but I'm an enterprise technical coach. How did that work that way? I don't know. And how many furlongs are in a mile anyway? I have no idea about that either.
I believe a furlong is 1/8 of a mile, or roughly 1/8 of a mile.
I don't want to remember that, but thank you for telling me.
Well, you have to be careful with furlongs, because if I remember correctly, there are 2 distinct measurements for a furlong. Let me check.
So,
and yeah. Sorry, I used to work in horse racing, which is the only reason I happen to know this.
Well, why would I bring it? Yes, see, there we go. And the answer is...
It is 80. It is 40 poles, which is 1/8 of a mile.
Oh, you got it right. And there's 40 poles in a furlong.
But there are multiple furlongs.
Yeah, but of course there would be.
Because who wouldn't want to make
it? Well, yeah, but is it a European furlong, or the African furlongs migratory or not? If you get two of them, like carrying a branch between each of them.
But do you know where the name of, or the measurement of a furlong comes from?
I do not, and I want to know. Please tell me.
It is the length of the furrow in 1 acre of plowed open field.
A furlong, of course.
I mean, who would not think to come up with this as a measurement and to continue using it?
So I'm on episode 102 of the History of the English Language podcast, which... for some reason, I love, but it's all about little silly things in history.
Oh, I can words. Only imagine how many funny things they have to come up with.
It's a hoot. If you can listen to it without paying a lot of attention, and you get each show, you get three or four little kind of cool things to remember later on. Last story, that they released the audio tapes, the transmissions of this Tucson super drone. So the cops... were chasing a drone because they thought it was a drug smuggler, and it just went faster and higher than they could, and it just blew their minds. Was it a UFO? Was it a super drone? Was it BS? Nobody knows, but they've got the transcripts for it.
So, since we got into English, I will have to give you one of my favorite words in English.
Ooh, okay.
Snicker's knee.
Snicker's knee. Never heard of it.
Yeah. It is actually referring to a knife.
What does it mean?
It's a type of knife that was used like back in the 1700s.
So one of my favorites is absquatulate.
Absquatulate?
Yes, which means
I don't believe I know this one.
It means to leave. I love English. I love the wordplay. I loved it for a long time. Cool stuff. We have an amazing language, like 400,000 words in it. It's nowhere else has a language like that.
Well, there's a fun one if you go up to Scotland.
I hear they speak. Some of those people actually speak English up there.
try pulling it up in Google. Wabbit.
Wabbit? Like Elmer Wabbit. Fudd? Elmer Fudd? Wabbit?
Well, just as Elmer Fudd would say, it's actually a term.
Okay.
It's actually a term that's used up in Scotland.
Does it? It means rabbit. Does it?
No.
Oh, okay. Whoa. Hang on. I'm not going to get punched in the head or anything, am I?
No.
Okay.
Just put Scotland rabbit into Google, and you will bring it up.
I what was it? Churchill. Scotland. Rabbit. And the answer is, yeah, word of the day, wabbit, webbit. exhausted, out of breath, unable to function due to extreme tiredness.
You are wabbit.
You're wabbit.
I'm pretty sure you will be able to use that in actual conversation in the future.
So I think it was Churchill, or maybe it was Patton, was giving a speech. And he said, it's great to be here in England. He said, where we have a great people divided by a common language. So let me do this. Let me do this final thing here. Hang on a second.
And hold on. I got a good laugh for you.
Okay.
So all the way back when I was in high school, I used to play a lot of football, also known as soccer in the U.S. And my coach, even back in high school, was actually British.
Ooh.
And he was from the West. We used to have a good time with him, calling him varying names from where he was from. He was from Liverpool. You really don't want to have a Scouser football coach.
Oh, no. We went to Australia a few years ago and we visited some of Melissa's friends, and they were. I met the husband. We were going out for a beer or chips or something to bring back to the girls. And the guy said, "Hey, this is Tuesday night. It's my favorite night. This is the time we get into the Nikas." I'm like, "Or if you're getting your Nikas, I don't, that's okay." And he meant NCIS, the crime show that's so popular, but he just pronounced it Nikas. I was like, okay. And we're friends, but I just met you guys. I don't know. I just.
this seems a bit Kentucky for me.
very Kentucky, doesn't it? Let me do the goodbye thing. It's been like, probably lost all seven people listening. I gotta say. So there you go. It's yet another Nerd Roundup, and you've wasted a complete hour and a half this time. But you've learned probably a lot of good words, like if Squatchy-wit, you've learned how long a furlong is. You've studied the ancient art of UFO chasing. You've got a hug from Google, maybe from behind. You've learned about publishing. There's been a ton of stuff you did that's useful today. We're happy to have you, and I will see you on the internet.